Welcome to CYC Podcast, Discussions on Child and Youth Care, episode number, I'm going to do that again. Welcome to CYC Podcast, Discussions on Child and Youth Care, episode number 126. I'm Wolfgang Vachon. Today we're going to continue the conversation that we started last week with Véronique Church-Duplessis from White Ribbon. If you haven't listened to the conversation from the last episode, episode 126 from the last week of April, I encourage you to listen to that conversation first. It gives you a bit of a context to what we will be sharing. So, Véronique, thank you so much for continuing this conversation and for staying with me today.
My pleasure.
When we ended last week, we were talking about this idea of consent culture and thinking what would that look like. I want to move a little bit into some concrete things. So there's some personal actions that I as a man can take. I can be conscious of the language I use, how I interact with others, addressing what I see and what I hear. There's also structural issues. And I'd like to ask you, what are some of the structural issues that are related to gender-based violence?
So those structural issues are directly linked to the root causes of gender-based violence that I mentioned in our previous conversation. So thinking back to the patriarchy as a system of oppression that influences our interaction in our culture, looking back at gender norms and expectations, and in our society, in our culture, in our institutions, they're very deeply influenced by these patriarchal ideas and by gender norms. And they influence the way in which people think and the way in which they behave. So looking specifically to men, there is a lot of pressure in our society for men to behave in a certain way. There are also pressures for women to behave in specific ways as well, but I'd like to pay more attention here to the ways we expect men to live and express their manhood in our society. So basically, when we think about what modern manhood is, there's a lot of pressure for men to be successful, still a lot of pressure for them to be providers. Oftentimes, we expect them to be stoic, to be tough, emotionless even. And there's also the expectation that they will be straight, right? So there's this definition of successful men that also includes getting the girl, right? If you're successful, the assumption is that you will get the woman that you want, and those expectations are very, very limiting, and it is easier for some men than others to break out of what we often call a gender box. And it's easier for some to shed those gender expectations, but for others, losing or the threat of losing the approbation of their peers, the approval of their peers is quite daunting. So that those gender expectations do weigh heavily on men, especially on young men. Now, if I ask you, what emotions do you think are widely acceptable for men? What emotions can men express without fearing being judged or criticized for it, or being told to man up? I would put that in quotation marks.
the first ones that pop into my mind, you know, that seem to be quite acceptable, you know, this idea of anger or just like jealousy is often justified. Happiness, I think men can be happy. There tends to be these fairly broad emotions, I think, that are allowed, and I would say they're equally broad, but perhaps different, that are allowed for women.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, those high concept, very common emotions like joy and anger, and these are seen as socially acceptable. Sadness to some extent, as long as oftentimes what we tell them, we tell young boys and men that they shouldn't cry, or explicitly or implicitly. And in a way, what is happening here is that we're stifling men's ability to express a full range of emotion. Some difficult emotions such as shame or guilt or humiliation, they're difficult for everyone to express, but I think it's particularly hard for young men to openly express those emotions without the fear of being told to man up, basically saying that they're failing at being a man if they have those emotions. And we have a structural issue here in terms of how our society is stifling those emotions. And while there's a clear connection between that and anger as often becoming the default emotion for a lot of men, and anger, when not properly managed, does lead to violence. So all of this is connected to gender-based violence and other forms of violence against women and girls. And there are other structural causes of gender-based violence in our societies. If we look back, for example, to colonialism for indigenous communities, violence was a way of subjugating colonized peoples and the destruction of traditional family structures with residential schools and high rates of incarceration and other sources of trauma and social dislocation for indigenous communities do contribute to very high rates of gender-based violence and violence generally in those communities, and that is structural. That's a structural issue. It's there is obviously individual responsibility in terms of how people manage and express their emotions and cope, but overall, when we're looking at those gender expectations and looking at colonialism and all of that, that deeply influences gender-based violence. And one way to move beyond that is to start helping young boys particularly develop their emotional intelligence, so their ability to not only recognize a full range of emotion, but also express them and use them in a constructive way.
And you know, that, I mean, a great deal of the work that I and people listening to this do is very much working with young people. And we know disproportionately young males are put into the incarceration system, child welfare system, and those other structures that are capturing children and youth, you know, special education programs. Again, you spoke about colonialism, but you know, special education tends to be disproportionately racialized young people. All these things are forms of violence. So for those of us who work with young people, are there things that we can do to help young people develop their emotional intelligence, emotional range, you know, to express those more nuanced and perhaps less culturally acceptable emotions?
Well, one thing is role modeling, right? Young men often look up to adults to see what types of behaviors and attitudes are acceptable. So I think that it is very valuable for them to see the men in their lives have a rich emotional life, being able to express a wide range of emotions and share them, and seeing that they are comfortable with all of those emotions, and that they won't be ostracized if they do express those emotions, if they cry. And I think that a critical discussion about that, all of these things are often assumed and they're not openly discussed, but whenever we have workshops in schools with young boys in one of our healthy masculinities or boys conferences, lights go up when we sit down with boys in grade 6 or grade 7 or 8 and we talk about that, and when we talk about all of these emotions, and what we see is that they're experiencing those emotions, but they're having a really hard time articulating them. So anything from helping them recognize emotions using an emotions wheel, and then talking about times where they can or can't express emotion and what's standing in the way, and trying to come up with strategies, and even making them practice expressing those emotions and dealing with them in a constructive way. It can be helpful, but it is important, I think, to mention the root causes of all this and help explain to them that this is not an individual issue, but that they shouldn't be ashamed of this, but that there are lots of pressures in our society in terms of what we expect, how we expect men and young boys to behave, and take a critical look at that and see how we can change those expectations by starting to work on at a small scale level, starting to work individually with young people and then with groups of young boys. And there's a lot of space for educators to include that and encourage young people to express their emotions in the classroom, even and not just young women, but encouraging young boys to do so as well.
Absolutely. You talked about emotions helping people develop the vocabulary and expressing and practicing expressing and giving space to expressing. You also talked about educating around some of the structural issues that limit young boys and young women, for that matter, in expressing emotions. Are there other things that those who work with children and youth can do to address gender-based violence?
Role modeling, as I mentioned before, is very important. So it doesn't just limit itself to emotional intelligence, but it is very important for adults to model healthy, equitable, and respectful relationships, whether that be with intimate partners or any other person in your life. I think that there is a lot of space for adults to talk about gender equality, to talk about the difference between healthy and unhealthy relationships, to talk about consent with young people. Young people are learning all of that, and they're taking a lot of their cues from the adults in their lives. So I think that it is important for teachers and educators and parents and coaches to set a good example. And we have a program at White Ribbon called It Starts With You, It Stays With Him, particularly geared towards male role models. So helping teachers and coaches and parents who are male identified set good examples with the young men in their lives. So we have a whole array of tools to help these men's ability to be good role models. So stories and tips and definitions and anything you can think about in terms of setting the stage and preparing them to be good role models and preparing them to have those conversations with the young men in their lives. And another thing that follows that is the ability to talk to young people about gender-based violence and sexual violence. They need to be made aware of it so that they can spot it. They can be more attuned to situations that might be problematic, that they might be more willing to trust their gut when they see something that doesn't seem right. And so that they know that it's okay to set boundaries and it's important to respect boundaries. It's also okay to get help when something seems a little weird or a little dodgy. That they should trust their instinct in those cases. So another one of our program is we're part of the Draw the Line campaign in Ontario. And what the campaign does is that it brings conversations about sexual violence into the classrooms. And we start quite young. We start with them in grade one, trusting them, telling them to trust their instinct when things don't feel right, giving young people the vocabulary they need to describe a situation that makes them feel uncomfortable and making them comfortable reaching out for help when something problematic happens. And then we build from there. And then we build it up to grade 12 and in post-secondary institutions, just giving students and educators the tools they need to have conversations about these topics, to raise awareness and get them to practice the skills they need to spot and intervene when they see sexual violence.
Absolutely. I think that's really important to, you know, that adults who are working with young people need to have that range as well, right? And it's continuing, it's ongoing. You know, as you were talking, I was remembering a couple incidences when I was a young person, preteen, early teenagers, and saying really quite inappropriate and offensive and sexually violent things in the presence of adult teachers and camp counselors and things like that, and really being addressed right away. And I remember those moments of, you know, adult men saying, this is not acceptable language, this is why it's not acceptable language, and this is, and that you can't, you know, saying that is a form of violence, and really being called to task you know, in that. And I think that really helped frame, oh yeah, that this isn't just a joke, this is more than just a joke, and if I think this way, that they're, you know, my actions may then be influenced by that thinking. And I think those were really important. So I think it is crucial that we as adults identify and call out that behavior.
Absolutely, and also take the time to explain why that behavior is not acceptable and not tolerated. When we look at young boys, they're often looking for ways of fitting in, and sometimes they follow some misguided ideas. And I think that it is very powerful when an adult takes the time to especially an adult, a male-identified adult, takes the time to sit down with them and explain why that is problematic or misguided.
Yeah, and I both of those older adults did that with me, and I thought that was really helpful. We started this conversation about talking last week around us coming from male identified and female identified, and the need to listen when women are speaking, and not require women to speak, not demand that women speak when I, as a guy, decide that I want to have a conversation about gender-based violence, whenever that might be. Some of the, well, all of the critiques we received on Facebook from our last episode were from women, and I you know, was incredibly, I thought, generous of them to take the time to do that teaching. How can male identifying, female identifying, and other gender identifying people, how can we come together to work on this issue? What does that look like, or do you have any thoughts or suggestions on ways to move forward across genders when dealing with gender-based violence?
Yes, absolutely. I think that it is important to work in partnership, right? And one thing that people don't always expect when they call White Ribbon, and I think that you experienced that yourself, is that we work on healthy masculinities and preventing gender-based violence, and we work oftentimes with men and boys, but our team here is diverse. We don't only have male-identified folks in the office, and the reason behind that is that this is a conversation and work that needs to happen in partnership, and everybody has as a role to play, and this is not a women's issue. It's everyone's issue. It's not just a man's issue either. I think that it is important to sit down and learn from each other and draw on each other's strengths and move this issue forward, move forward together. And I think it's important that, particularly for the young generation, I think it's very important for them to see this type of work in partnership, to see men step up and talk about it, and to see that they're doing so from a place of maybe humility, from a place of being accountable and open and responsive to the women and the feminist organizations who have been doing this work for several generations now. And it's important that men and women work together on this, and it's important also that men don't try to steal the spotlight, or that they don't try to take women's authority on that matter aside, and that they take time to listen, and that they're open to criticisms when maybe something that they were trying to help, the intentions are good, but sometimes the approach or the delivery is not without its issues. So I think just being open to these criticisms and being constantly looking to grow and to take your cues from the women who have been doing this work is important. But all of this requires openness and partnership and conversations, and it is truly work for everyone of any gender identity. The same thing should be done in terms of opening space and listening to members of the LGBTQ community and their own experiences of gender discrimination and violence.
Absolutely. You know, I think you make you make so many good points in our conversation, but one of the things that strikes me is that, you know, there has been, you know, generations of feminist women addressing gender-based violence, and that there's a phenomenal amount that's been written and thought about, and there's materials that have been developed over the past decade, and there's just huge amounts that are available that doesn't require me demanding somebody sit down in front of me and have that conversation. So it's not difficult to find materials created by women and by other men. So
yeah,
to really honor that history and the hard work that's been
yes,
done.
I think that's the first step of a men's efforts to become part of the solution and working to end gender-based violence is just starting by educating yourself. And there is a lot of material in a lot of different formats out there, and it's a really good starting point. And once you have done that work, it's a good time to reach out and see how you can help. But taking the initiative and being proactive and making sure that you educate yourself first is I think a testimony of your commitment to the issue, and also a responsible way of doing it that doesn't take too much physical, intellectual, or emotional labor for the women who are still very heavily involved in this.
Absolutely. As we start to come towards the close of this second conversation that we've had, there's a couple things I just want to touch on. One of the things that comes up a lot is this idea, and we see this in the media, is this idea of false accusations, and that people are, you know, accusing men of sexual violence, sexual assault, and it's not true. And I'd like to have a bit of a conversation about that. Do you know what the rates of false accusations are when it comes to particularly sexual violence?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So the first thing is that people don't lie about being sexually assaulted more than they would about any other crimes. So most studies show that for Canada, the UK, US, and Australia, the rate of false accusations is between 2% and 4%. Now, what's interesting here is that takes only into account the cases of sexual assault that are reported to the police. And perhaps you and members of your audience know this, but the number of sexual assaults that are reported to the police as opposed to those that aren't, well, it's the most underreported crime pretty much everywhere. So in Canada, we're looking at 33 per thousand, or 3.3% of all sexual assaults that do get reported to the police. So the vast majority of survivors
so
do not.
97% of sexual assaults are not being reported.
They're not. Wow. Yes. They're not being reported. So if you take into account all of those 97% of sexual assaults that aren't reported, and you do a bit of math and you look at the rate of false accusations and all, so overall, of all those cases, if you add it all up and do a comparison, you have fewer than 1 per 1,000 cases of sexual assault that are that is considered false. And we also have to take into account how the judicial process is quite difficult, and there is a tendency from law enforcement agencies across the country to dismiss cases of sexual assault as unfounded at a very high rate. So that means that the police doesn't think that a crime took place, or that they don't think there's enough evidence to classify an incident as a crime. It always comes up, this question of false accusation, and any time I do a workshop or anything like that, it does come up. There's a lot, it's one of those persistent myths around sexual violence. There are quite a few, but that's one that comes up very, very often. Those cases are extremely rare, but they do get a lot of attention. And that's where a lot of people's misconceptions come from. And I think that we're not doing a service to the survivors if we're putting too much emphasis on false accusations. That prevents them from reporting, makes them think that they won't be believed, fear that they won't be taken seriously. So that puts a lot of barriers up for survivors, and we're failing in terms of being able to support them if we put too much emphasis on the idea that it might be a false accusation. And another thing that I can mention when it comes to this is our society and justice system is not very well equipped to deal with survivors of sexual violence. The process can be harrowing. Survivors are often shamed or insulted or threatened by the perpetrators, who often are in position of power, or by society at large. And the justice system often forces them to relieve their trauma over and over again, and puts their life under scrutiny. So there's a lot of pressure on survivors who choose to disclose and report to the police. And given the way that these women are treated when they go ahead with a judicial process, and given the way that they're treated by society at large, especially if they're accusing someone who's powerful or popular and all of that, there's not much to be gained. They really are put through a process that is quite, quite difficult. And oftentimes we see recantations from women, not because a crime didn't take place, but because they eventually didn't have the financial, psychological, or physical support they needed to go through with the process. That happens to quite a lot of survivors. They eventually prefer to focus on their own recovery outside of the judicial system, and they recant their cases and testimonies.
There was a piece I read in the paper this morning about a legal case where in the written decision, it was a three panel, it was an appeal case, and the judges twice in the written decision called the victim of the sexual assault the appellate, basically called them the person who had been charged with the crime, and it's perhaps a typo, perhaps an error, but I think it really speaks, I thought, profoundly to how the judicial system frames people who come forward, that an error could be made, that the person who has been sexually assaulted, she was 14 at the time of the sexual assault, could be called the appellate, the defendant. It was just appalling to me.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, and that explains why so few cases are reported. A lot of survivors believe, and they might be right, that their own path to recovery, their own recovery will be better served by not undergoing this traumatic judicial process, especially given that the rate of conviction for for the 3% of those that are reported to the police is extremely low. People often calculate that it's probably not worth it.
What is worth it is reaching the white ribbon. And as we move towards the end of this conversation, in a desperate attempt not in any way to minimize the absolute, you know, the reality of I don't want to in any way minimize or make light of it. I do want to end, though, that there are things that we can do, and white
yes.
ribbon is one of the things that we can do. And so maybe if people are interested in connecting with White Ribbon, what maybe you can tell us a little bit more about any programs that you run or how they can reach out with you, just as we start to wrap this up.
Yes, absolutely. So we run a number of programs. A lot of them focus on healthy gender norms and healthy masculinities and violence prevention. So it's possible to book our workshops and have one of our community engagement managers go in your school and your community or your workplace and deliver a workshop that just gets people really thinking critically about gender norms and expectations. And I think giving them concrete suggestions and actions that they can take to prevent violence and help advance gender equality in their community. So if you go to our website, we have a section that details our various workshops, and you can book and request a workshop through there. So our website is simply whiteribbon.ca. If you're interested in the male role model resources and toolkit, you will find that on its campaign website. So that is itstartswithyou.ca. And if you're interested in the Sexual Violence Prevention Initiative, the Draw the Line Sexual Violence Prevention Initiative, that one you will, all of our resources for educators and students and all of that, you will find those on our DTL, for Draw the Line, dtl.whiteribbon.ca. And you can always send us an email for any question or request at info@whiteribbon.ca. And we'll put the links on your website as well to
Absolutely.
Help.
Absolutely.
Folks, yes.
So even 1 hour isn't enough to cover everything. we at CYC Podcast make a commitment to continue having this conversation with people of diverse genders over the coming months and years. But is there anything else that we missed that you really want to touch on before we say goodbye for a second time?
Well, I think that the important piece here is to continue to have those conversations and not shy away from them, because they can be difficult. We're not helping anyone by helping perpetuate this culture of silence. We're not helping survivors. On the contrary, if survivors know that the people around them are aware of the fact that this is an issue, they're more likely to know that they're not alone. They're more likely to reach out for help and open up about their experiences, and that can help their recovery. It's also important to, I think, for male identified folks to continue this conversation, to talk amongst themselves about the concrete steps that they can take to help make society a better place, a safer place for women and for everyone else. And I think that the last piece, I think it might go without saying, but for anyone who has been impacted by sexual violence, I think, as we've made clear, I think it's important for them to know that they're not alone and that there are people in their communities who are able to help. And if they're ready to reach out to the various services in their communities, I think it's important to encourage them to do so and tell them that we believe them and that we're there to support them.
Absolutely. Veronique, I want to thank you so, so much for taking the time today to speak with me. Very extended conversation, incredibly worthwhile, and I think you've done a fantastic job of unpacking a variety of things, giving us some really concrete things that can be used, and lots of ideas to think about. So I really appreciate you doing this work and you taking the time to have this conversation with all of us today.
Thank you for having us. I think that everybody benefits when podcasts and places like this open up those conversations and do give us a bit of a tribune to share our insights and help move this conversation forward and just raise awareness. And that's how we will be able to affect change in our society.
Absolutely. One conversation at a time, one action at a time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This concludes this month's episode of CYC Podcast. Tune in next time for more discussions on child and youth care. Subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher. Visit us on our website at cycpodcast.org. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/cycpodcast.